This episode is brought to you by Dr. Squatch. When your personal care routine needs a refresh, Dr. Squatch is here to help. They have high-performing natural products with no harmful ingredients that'll have you looking and smelling your best. Like the Bay Rum Soap and Deodorant. It smells delightfully spicy. And right now, they have an amazing offer for new customers. Get 20% off your first purchase of any amount or a subscription order by going to drsquatch.com/Spotify or use the code Spotify at checkout.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to your podcast, New Books in Economic and Business History. I'm your host, Javier Mejia from Stanford University. And today I have the great pleasure to be with Barry Eichengreen. Barry is professor of economics and political science at the University of California in Berkeley. He's research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. He's also a research fellow at the Center for Economic Policy Research. And he's the author, among a few other people, we're going to talk more about that in a bit, of a recently published book by Oxford University Press called In Defense of Public Debt. We're going to be talking today with Barry about the book and his career. Let me say hi to him. Hi, Barry. Thanks a lot for being here with us.
Good to be with you, Javier, even if you're from that other place down on the peninsula.
Yeah, we have this tension between our universities, but I'm glad that that does not translate in our relationship. You're a very well-known economist, Barry. I'm sure that many of our listeners have read your papers, your books, but probably not many of them know your story. I know that you grew up in the Bay Area. I think that's actually very interesting. But why don't we start with that? Why don't you tell us your story? How did you become a scholar? Why did you study economics? At what point did you realize that you were interested in monetary and financial history? Tell us a bit about that.
Well, not only did I grow up in the Bay Area, I grew up in Berkeley, California. As it happened, my parents were not academics, but we were surrounded by academics. So I would hear professors' conversations around their Saturday evening dinner party table. I learned that the professor's life has some pleasant aspects to it. It's kind of the only way once you have tenure, you have secure employment, but you don't really have a boss. Nobody can tell you what to do and when to do it exactly. There are very broad parameters about what you should be doing, but you define for yourself how to do it. So the professor's life had some appeal to me early on. I was attracted to history, and my interest in history goes way back. But I found doing history without a framework, just reading history, difficult. And if you look at how historians practice their craft, they all use a framework, different theoretical, analytical frameworks, sometimes visible, other times less visible. But I found a framework in economics. So I thought the models and methods of economics as applied to history helped me make sense, helped me order the messy disorder that is raw historical material. And I've been an economic historian ever since. So I had one inspiring teacher of economic history when I was an undergraduate, and that turned out to be a finishing PhD student from none other than Stanford University, one of Professor Paul David's students. And from that point, I thought putting economics and history together made a lot of sense. And I did that right from the outset of my graduate school PhD studies. Nowadays, very few people go to PhD programs in economics planning on doing economic history. They have to discover it, or we have to convert them, win them over. But I think I had discovered it before I got to the PhD program at Yale, and I've been pursuing it ever since.
Can I ask you more about that? I'm curious about how was the environment in economics towards economic history when you were a grad student? Was it perceived as a appropriate or convenient path of research, just as any other? Do you think that that has changed? What's your perspective on that?
Yale University, when I was there, was a little unusual in that they had a program in economic history where you did your PhD coursework in economics, then you took a year off and studied in the history department before you went back to your home department economics to finish, or you could do it from the other direction. So my longtime Berkeley colleague in the history department, Jan de Vries, did his coursework in history, spent a year in the economics department, went back to history to complete his PhD. He's in history, I'm in economics, but we both had the same dissertation supervisor. So that was a somewhat unusual program. And I think we economic historians got a lot of support from other economics faculty. So the famous Nobel laureate at Yale when I was there, Jim Tobin, was very supportive of what I did, and other economic historians did. And there were people like the great American historian C. Van Woodward, who were very supportive of us economists when we went the other way. And quite a number of, on the economic side, quite a number of well-known economic historians came out of that program when I was there in the late 1970s, early 1980s. I won't name names for fear of leaving someone out. Economic history was always a relatively small, specialized subdiscipline within economics. And, you know, there's always a tension in terms of who your audience is. Are you speaking, writing for other economic historians, or are you trying to write for the larger economics and history professions? If you're trying to write for the larger economics profession, you've got to rely more heavily on theory and metrics and all that. If you're trying to write for economic historians, they want to know more about the time and the place, the setting, the institutions. So that's a balance. How have things changed over time? I like to think that economic history has a larger audience within economics now and garners more respect within economics now than it did some years ago because of the data revolution. You know, we can digitize and manipulate large amounts of historical data. So the complete count U.S. decennial censuses from the 19th and 20th centuries are digitized and can be linked. You can follow individuals and families over time. We have the computing power to analyze data sets with millions of historical observations. So I think the fact that economics is now even more of an empirical discipline than it used to be. When I came up, the theorists kind of occupied the high ground in terms of, they were the high status people in economics. You can argue now that empirical work has regained the high ground, and that's good for economic history.
Totally. I mean, it's very inspiring, your perception of how the field is then evolving into a space of a larger audience and higher interest in the community. And I would like to take some of the things that you were describing regarding the tension that economic historians face when addressing their audience, right? To begin our conversation around the book, right? Because this is a book that is of potential interest to a very large audience, right? This could be a book that an economic historian wants to read because they want to know more about public debt, but also a policymaker would be really interested in reading this book and extracting specific lessons from that. And maybe the first thing that I would like to hear from you is, what is this particularity that public or sovereign debt has, right? You begin the book pointing out that it's not just as any regular debt. Could you say a bit more about that?
So we wrote this book, I think, to try to redress the balance. We started before COVID-19. Which kind of made the case for us that when a state faces an existential crisis, it needs to mobilize all available resources. And in the short run, it can do that only by borrowing. And so there is this positive aspect to public debt, as well as the negative forbidding aspect that you see in the debt clock on the side of a building in Times Square that is continuously updating how much your family owes in terms of the government's debt. So we tried to trace that over a long period of time and show how public debt had been used to fight defensive wars. The government of Ukraine is issuing bonds at the moment. How it was used by Italian city-states like Siena and others to ward off the Black Death, fight pandemics, and how it's been used over time to sometimes well, sometimes poorly, to foster economic development. So the book is aimed at a broad audience. We tried to speak not only to policymakers, but to the informed public. So I always hold readers of The Economist or The Wall Street Journal in my mind when I put fingers to keyboard or pen to paper. There are a couple of equations in the book where we try to explain the debt dynamics, the determinants of rising and falling debt levels, but we suppressed the temptation to talk in terms of equations insofar as possible.
Right. And now that you mentioned that the debt has played this important role fighting wars, that seems to be an important part of your description of the origins of well-established market for foreign debt, right? That takes place specifically in Europe and, well, I guess what we could call the early modern era. What's the particularity of Europe during this period? Why is this happening? I don't want to make this one of those big conversations about why the West and not other parts of the world, but how do you think about this?
That's right. So one does not see comparable levels of public or sovereign or state debt in other parts of the world, in the Ottoman Empire or in China until centuries after its appearance, after the development of markets and public debt in Europe. So we had to make that case carefully. Europe-centric history is out of fashion. History for too long was overly Eurocentric. And then, of course, came what you and I like to call the California school of history, of economic history, that it expressly compares the West with the East and the West with China in particular, and argues that along a number of dimensions, China was ahead of the West for a long period, China invented clocks and big sailing ships and gunpowder and so forth. So we had to be careful in shifting the focus back to Europe, where issuance and markets in public debt are precocious, where they develop first. And the reason for that is Europe's distinctive political geography. If you look at it in the early modern period, you see that the continent is divided up into hundreds of territorial states and city-states, all of which are butted up against one another, bringing them into conflict over borders and such. That contrasts with China, which was all unified basically as a single empire more than 2,000 years ago. So that different political geography led to different public debt histories, and that different political geography was rooted in different physical geography. So Europe is a continent divided by multiple mountain ranges and river valleys and natural obstacles to territorial political unification, whereas China, east of the Himalayas, is basically a great plain where it was possible for a single imperial government to expand its control, build a great wall, and keep invaders from the outside safely away to the north. So the need to issue debt in order to fight wars didn't arise in the same way in China and more broadly in other parts of the world than Europe.
Okay. I think that it's one of the things that I found particularly interesting of the book is this profound reflection of political factors behind the evolution of monetary and fiscal phenomena, right? And I would like to move a bit in that direction, right? So one of the the very long-term facts that you describe in the book, which is great, pointing out again the fact that brings all this long-term data from many different parts of the world, which I think it's very insightful, is this long-term trend of interest rates down, right? So real interest rates are declining if you see the very long term. And you have some discussion about why is that the case. You focus on some periods more than other, in particular in the early modern era, and how that was related to the consolidation of these markets for debt. But could you say more about that?
Well, I should start by crediting Paul Schmelzing, who's a PhD from Harvard, a postdoctoral fellow at Yale, soon to be a assistant professor elsewhere, who put together these very long-term data on interest rates, on government bonds, on sovereign debt, and traced their gradual downward movement over a period of 700 years. So we've been talking recently about how the level of interest rates has declined over the last three or four decades. Some people refer to that phenomenon as secular stagnation, but Paul puts that in very long-term perspective. And I think it reflects a couple of things. First of all, politics, as you alluded to a moment ago, that with the creation of checks and balances on arbitrary action by the sovereigns, historically had to compensate their bankers by paying them high interest rates because the sovereign could unilaterally renege on his obligations. He was the highest earthly power. Nobody could tell him not to until there was a separate branch of government, a legislature or a parliament, whose permission had to be obtained in order to raise taxes or increase government spending or whatever. So one of your Stanford colleagues, Barry Weingass, together with Douglas North, made this argument influentially like 30 years ago. They pointed to the Glorious Revolution in England as case in point. There's been a lot of debate about exactly what happened to interest rates around that particular revolution. But I think the broader point is correct that with the development of political systems in which the creditors, the bondholders, also have a voice, and it was creditors, bondholders, landowners who served in these early parliaments and legislatures in England, in Holland, elsewhere, you saw the cost of borrowing interest rates begin to come down over time. The Dutch case is a remarkable one. Between 1600 and 1700, you see the real interest rate on Dutch government bonds declining from on the order of 8% to 2% when they put their estates general, their legislature in place. And secondly, markets in these bonds begin to develop so that they can be traded. The bonds become more liquid. If people need to turn their investment into cash, they can do so, which makes holding bonds, you know, on those days when they don't need cash, more attractive. People are willing to bid more for the bonds. Interest rates on them are correspondingly lower. So the development of those markets eventually backstopped by a liquidity provider of last resort, namely the central bank, is another important element of why these interest rates come down. So I think it's a combination of political factors, like you cited, together with economic and financial development.
Do you have any particular opinion on the most recent part of that trend? We're going to get back to the history of the book, and I know you're book does not exactly address with the shortest term conjuncture, but it seems that we're very close to what could be a natural lower bound to the decline of interest rates. Do you think that we're going to be in this equilibrium for very long? Is this just a short-term trend and eventually we're going to go back to whatever was a previous equilibrium?
If you look at the behavior of real interest rates adjusted for inflation, they bounce around a lot because the inflation rate can bounce around a lot. But I underlying that are slowly moving trends. So interest rates were slowly trending downward on average most recently since the early 1980s. And I think there is reason to think that they have now more or less hit bottom and that trend may begin to reverse and we'll see a gradual trend in the direction of higher real interest rates. Demographic factors point in that direction. Savings rates in high saving economies like China may come down to more internationally normal levels. There may be unusually high levels of investment for a couple of decades now because of the need to finance what we wrote in the book about the green and digital transformations. But we can add increased military spending now in a variety of countries. So changes in demography and savings behavior and investment behavior may all now begin to reverse those trends, and that will make managing our inherited debts more challenging. So we don't deny the existence. You know, we emphasize positive aspects of using the instrument of public debt, but we don't deny the challenges we're going to now face. We used it for good reason in the COVID episode, but now there's a management legacy, a management challenge that will become more difficult with higher interest rates.
Let's talk about that. You, in the book, talk about, I guess, two historical episodes that bring different lessons of how to deal with the management of debt, right? So you show how in the 19th century, at least the last part of the 19th century, when you look at the UK and you look at France and the US, what you see is basically a decline of debt as share of the GDP, right? So basically those countries, and it seems to be the case of some other advanced economies apparently, were able to decline to reduce their debt. Why was that the case? What was happening in these places during this period?
Heavy public debts in Britain, in the United States after our Civil War, in France after the Franco-Prussian War were brought down. The debt to GDP ratio was brought down to much lower levels. In Britain, over more than 90 years, between 1820 and the outbreak of World War I, 1914, by running budget surpluses, by running what economists refer to as primary budget surpluses, where you ignore money spent on debt service for present purposes. So the subtext here is the question: Britain could run budget surpluses year after year for fully 90 years. Do you think we could do this in the United States or other countries in our position today? Britain was able to do it then because the franchise who could vote, who could sit in parliament, was limited to men with property who met a property threshold, held a certain amount, owned a certain amount of land, and often also owned government bonds. So these were people who were interested in being sure that the government maintained and enhanced its capacity to service debt by retiring outstanding debt where it was dangerously heavy. Part of it was the recognition that there might be another war or need to borrow again in the future. The French retired their debt in part because they were looking forward to the risk of another war, perhaps with Germany. So they wanted to restore their capacity to borrow, and that was enough to galvanize the political process to run budget surpluses rather than deficits. So the point being that political economy is very different today. It's not only the creditors who have a voice. Politics are arguably more polarized than they have been in a long time, making it hard for parties to agree on a debt management strategy and to sustain it over long periods of time. So it's clear that how they successfully dealt with their heavy debts in the 19th century is that tactic alone is not going to work today. After World War II, just to continue, governments reduced their debt to GDP ratios mainly by growing the denominator of the ratio, by growing their economies. The third quarter of the 20th century was the fastest period of fastest, most rapid economic growth in the history of the world. So that successfully brought down debt ratios. Are we going to be able to grow our economies as quickly as we did in that period when there was a backlog of technology available to us as a result of the Great Depression and World War II? I'm skeptical. So I'm not sure that avenue exclusively is going to be available to us either.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
I want to ask you regarding this. So, I mean, it's fascinating to compare those two periods, right? Like how you could have a consistent reduction of debt in for so long in many of these countries, and then just the opposite trend in which we're seeing increasing debt levels for a very long term. And besides these factors that you describe associated with the political economy of the period, do you think that there has been a change in the ideas behind how people think about debt, how much we consider reasonable debt, what's the purpose of that debt? And I'm asking you because in a certain way, you're trying to influence that conversation. So I guess I'm interested in your perspective of how that conversation has evolved over time.
So if you stop someone on the street, they will draw an analogy between the household budget constraint, a household has to live with it in its means, and the government budget constraint, where if you stop an economist in the hallway of the economics department, they'll say the two budget constraints are not exactly analogous with one to one another. So in our, ever since Keynes's general theory, I think views of public debt have evolved, are different from Adam Smith's view that governments face the same budget constraint as households and have to repay everything that they borrow sooner or later. How much debt is safe? Views of that change as well. They should change because how much debt is sustainable depends on the level of interest rates. We were touching on that earlier. It depends on the rate of growth of the economy. When economists talk about sustainable levels of debt these days, they use the shorthand R minus G, where R is the real interest rate paid on the debt and G is the real growth rate of the economy. So when circumstances change, views of public debt change as well, both because of changes in economic theory, Keynes and his general theory, and because of changes in current economic conditions.
And can I don't want to put you in the spot, but I'm curious, like now that we're talking about changes in economic theory, do you have any thoughts about these ideas that people would call modern monetary theory, which many would argue that it's an extreme position regarding how much debt, for instance, a government could take. Do you have any position regarding those type of ideas? You think they're part of the large discussion, we should take them very seriously? I don't know. I want to hear what you think about that.
I find it difficult to talk about modern monetary theory because it means different things to different people. It's hard to pin down exactly what we're talking about. My interpretation of it is that governments can borrow unlimited amounts insofar as the central bank is there to buy up the resulting public debt without inflationary consequences. So modern monetary theory became influential or remarked upon, at least, in the period when central banks were buying up government debt big time without inflationary consequences. So the irony is, number one, that this is a model or a view of the world that that does obtain at sometimes in some places, but not in others. If you're in a liquidity trap situation with interest rates becalmed at zero and no inflation on the horizon, then some of the implications of modern monetary theory do follow. But the irony is it no sooner became influential or remarked upon than that period ended. Now we're in a more inflationary world where it's no longer the case that central banks can engage in asset purchase programs without inflationary consequences.
That's very interesting. And I mean, your response opens the door to asking you something I was wondering while I was reading your book, and is related to the, I guess, the variance across types of debt. So you spend quite a bit of time arguing that the type of debt that a country has matters, right? So the type of currency in which the debt is issued, well, the features of the government that issues it, the market where it is traded. How do you think about that in general? Like, how much do you think that fiscal and monetary advice should be narrowed to different types of countries, right? Should we have a certain type of protocol for developing regions that it's different from the one of advanced economies? What are your thoughts on this?
So I have a couple of thoughts here. One goes back 25 years to when Ricardo Hausmann, now at Harvard, and I were working on foreign currency denominated debt, and we wrote about the problem of original sin, as we called it, where it appeared that many governments around the world were able to sell to foreign investors only bonds denominated in dollars or very short-term debt. And we observed that having your debt denominated in someone else's currency puts you at great risk if the exchange rate moves. Selling only short-term debt puts you at rollover risk if the appetite for your bonds dries up abruptly. And we argued that it was going to be a long haul. It was going to be difficult for emerging market governments to convince international investors to buy long-term bonds denominated in their own currencies. So a subset of emerging markets set out down that road and have done relatively well, such that they are able to sell market long-term domestic currency denominated debt, where they are able to sell it to local investors. I think it makes their financial position much more secure. When they sell it to foreign investors, though, those foreign investors still, then it's going to be the foreign investors who worry about the exchange rate moving and the American investors worrying that their peso denominated debt is going to lose value if the peso depreciates against the dollar. So Yun Shin and colleagues at the Bank for International Settlements have shown that local currency denominated debt in the hands of foreign investors can still be a financial risk to emerging market governments. On your other point, I do think that developing countries with weaker fiscal systems, less ability to raise tax revenues, other things equal, have less capacity to service debt. And therefore, they should keep their debt to GDP ratios lower, for example, than advanced economies with much more elaborate fiscal systems able to mobilize more resources. There were a few economists years back who tried to figure out exactly what that magic number was, that emerging markets shouldn't have debt to GDP ratios above 35% and advanced economies shouldn't have debt to GDP ratios above 90%. We've learned that there are no magic numbers, and what is safe depends on those factors you and I were talking about before. Real interest rates, growth rates of the economy, but also the nature and the scope of the fiscal system.
Right. This is fascinating. I'm as you know, I'm Colombian, and we're having this not only in Colombia, but in Latin America, this entire shift in politics, and that's coming with changes in the conversation around how we should treat fiscal and monetary policy. And like, there's so many like profound insights in what you're saying about how we should think about this. So I'm very happy that you're bringing up this issues. But let me ask you, I guess, a general question. And with this, we're starting to come to the last part of our conversation. And it's about broader lessons from your book. So the book has several sections that are literally titled Lessons on This Period. What do you think are the biggest lessons that come out of the book for, I guess, both the conversation around debt, but also the way in which we should think about fiscal and monetary policy?
That public debt is a powerful and valuable instrument to deploy in emergencies, be those wars, pandemics, financial crises, or whatever. We have just passed through a period marked by successive crises, so we've utilized that weapon and kind of depleted our reserves, if you will. So I do think it's imperative now to for governments to restore, strengthen their capacity to borrow, especially given that that capacity will be strained going forward by those higher interest rates. The ways that governments restored that capacity in the past are not going to be available to the same extent today, because growth rates are going to be slower than in the mid-20th century. Budget surpluses are going to be harder to sustain than in the mid-19th century. So I think we're going to have to follow a combination of tactics, running budget surpluses or minimizing the budget deficit insofar as possible, trying to accelerate the rate of growth of the economy. And I think there are opportunities through those digital and green revolutions to find productive investments that will translate into faster growth. And modest inflation, avoiding deflation, is probably the more politically correct way of putting it. Avoiding deflation is helpful from this point of view as well. And staying the course and being lucky also. So the 19th century was not entirely a period of peace, but the Britain was involved in the Crimean War in the middle of the century, in the Boer War at the end of the century, but it wasn't engaged in extensive military spending all through the period. A future that's not marked by crises to the same extent as the recent past was marked by crises would be helpful as well. That's, you know, hoping against hope.
That's very interesting. You know, it's not very common to hear experts pointing out the importance of randomness and stochastic events, right? So I totally agree with you. Let's hope that we have a less eventful few decades ahead. Let me ask you one final question. And I ask this to all my guests, as this podcast is on books, and academia in particular in economics has moved since, well, a long time ago to format in which articles are more important, right? So I want to ask you, what do you think is the role of books and the generation of knowledge? Why writing a book? You have written not just this book, but many others, and you're actually probably one of the most prolific and successful economists writing books. Why do you do it? Do you think that there's space for that in the future? How does that feed into the larger scientific discussion. I want to hear what you think about that.
So I think about the role of books in a couple of ways. Number one, it allows you to develop a more complete argument than you can within the confines of a journal article. We see in economics increasingly that submissions to journals are very long. They almost look like books sometimes these days. So as a referee, I've seen the 90-page submission where the author says the last 60 pages will become an online appendix. So in a way, articles are becoming more like books nowadays, reflecting the recognition that you need to develop the argument more fully, where more fully may mean for some people more robustness checks, more regressions. For other people, it may mean developing additional dimensions of the argument. Secondly, I think of books as a vehicle for communicating with a broader audience, that you can use narrative methods, which may take up more space than an equation, but you can communicate with many more people who prefer words over symbols, mathematical symbols. Finally, I do think that books are important in the education of economists nowadays. So for some years now, I've been teaching a graduate course in economic history where we read 15 books in 15 weeks. At the moment, I have a dozen students in that course. It's an excuse for me to catch up on 15 books that I need to read. But we also read some modern classics in economic history. When the pandemic struck, we had to move to Zoom, of course. And we realized that we could invite the authors. So the format of the course became, we get together for an hour and analytically discuss the book. And then in the second hour, we discuss it with the author. So that makes reading these books even more appealing.
That's fascinating. I shouldn't say this publicly, but I would have loved to be at Berkeley and take your class. Well, Barry, thanks a lot. This was very interesting. I really appreciate your time. I highly recommend your book. I really think that there are many lessons for many people. So I really think that it's worth checking out. It is, again, In Defense of Public Debt. It's published by Oxford University Press. And well, thanks a lot, Barry.
Xavier, thank you for having me.